What happens then is we have an Omega candle, as Samson likes to talk, or we have multi-million dollar Bitcoin, we have a 10x jump overnight because we've now reached the saturation point where there's no longer any Bitcoin available to buy because everyone holding it doesn't want to sell it. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with OG Bitcoiners who are sitting on hundreds if not thousands of coins. And then there's a 1% chance that we find someone who runs a central bank, has access to a money printer, and can hold the fingers down till they bleed and just buy Bitcoin and set a new price at $1 million. And so I think it's not a matter of if it happens, I think it's a matter of when, and we might be a whole lot closer to that situation than where we were previously.
What's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm internally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. We are back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, recurring guest, Peter Dunworth. But Peter, man, do we have some bullish news to say the very least. But the interesting thing with all of this bullish news, all of these new Bitcoin treasury companies coming on, we aren't seeing the skyrockets in flight. We aren't seeing the rocket ship take off yet. So is it just a matter of time here, Peter, or are there something a little fishy going on here where, you know, we're seeing some whales sell off, maybe some collusion to keep the price down so people can scoop up as much corn as possible? What do you think's going on? And yeah, man, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you. I kind of think it's a choose your own adventure when you look at what's going on right now. You can buy into the paper, you know, paper Bitcoin myth that, oh, there's paper being sold and this is why we've got price suppression. You look at the on-chain analytics and the 80,000 coins to get hoovered up in a weekend and it doesn't drop more than 6% is a big, big deal. I can't help but think that that would be OTC desk putting together that order for Saylor on 21,000 coins from his recent announcement. But this I think is a beautiful market right now, is that, you know, we understand what all of these things mean. I think Bitcoin treasury companies are, you know, new this cycle, and we've seen a whole host of copycats spring up. But I look at this and think, this, what we're seeing right now is signs of a maturing asset class where, you know, volume is starting to get much, much bigger. And the important thing about this is this invites much bigger players into this space. And, you know, to absorb 80,000 coins in the space of a week or, you know, a few days, I think is probably the most important news that we've got, because if you look at the major capital allocators globally, they're not interested in pursuing opportunities that they can get into. What they're really concerned about is getting out of the opportunity when they don't like it. And so seeing 80,000 Bitcoins just bought up in a few days is very, very bullish for opening up that next wave of capital, the much larger wave of capital to come to Bitcoin. So although it might not look like at the moment with bullish price action, I think it lays the foundation for some significant bullish price action and buyers to start entering the market.
Yeah, and it's interesting you're saying all this because, you know, the narrative is that, you know, there's going to be diminished returns over time. But I mean, I for some reason just can't buy into that narrative. And a big part of it is just the amount of Bitcoin you're seeing on exchanges. And you mentioned OTC desks as well. I mean, these big dogs, they got to go somewhere, right? They're not just logging into a Coinbase account and buying these. And, you know, we're seeing that rapidly get taken off. And these guys, they're not selling. So do you believe in that narrative of the diminished returns? Or do you think we're going to, you know, have something where we get a little bit wonky here in the next year or so?
I think we can see diminished returns per se, but then that's going to break. And if you look at the logical conclusion to how, say, a lot of those Bitcoin maxis operate and what they, you know, how they run their personal lives, if you look at how the, you know, the reason for being for these Bitcoin treasury companies, you can't help but follow out the extension of, you know, the logical conclusion of all of their, you know, the intersection in years down the track is that no one is going to want to sell Bitcoin. So what happens then? What happens then is we have an Omega candle, as Samson likes to talk about, or we have a a multi-million dollar Bitcoin, we have a 10x jump overnight, because we've now reached the saturation point where there's no longer any Bitcoin available to buy because everyone holding it doesn't want to sell it. And that ushers in a whole new period of, I think, human civilization and monetization of Bitcoin. So obviously there'll always be a price that someone's willing to pay, but you look at these treasury companies, they've already told you they're going to buy Bitcoin until they're blue in the face or till their eyes bleed, and they're never going to sell it. And the second they sell their Bitcoin is the second they no longer become a Bitcoin treasury company, and the entire, you know, their entire investor base starts selling their stock. So they're a captive audience for that, and I think there's going to be downstream effects on that that has to place upward pressure, like an exponential pressure on a digitally scarce asset in Bitcoin.
Well, and I think it's unique too, because we've had essentially Saylor, you know, kind of leading the charge, and it seems like he keeps finding out new ways to buy more Bitcoin and issue more debt. I mean, he just offered this new offering, the STRC, where, you know, they're buying 21,021 Bitcoin. Obviously, there's some symbolism in there, but, you know, it seems like everywhere you turn, no matter what, with these treasury companies, you know, Saylor's leading the charge, and he's opening up the playbook and doing it all, and in fact, trying to bring others under his arm to mentor. Now, with this blowing up, would that be catastrophic if we had some of these smaller players? I'm not saying that MicroStrategy or Strategy B, now it's called, is going to blow up, but is there any, I guess, negative effect of all of these treasury companies coming on seemingly at the same time?
Look, I think proceed with caution with that. Obviously, it feels like the flavor of the month that everyone's getting involved in these treasury companies, and there have been some really outstanding performances in these treasury companies that just blow the absolute socks off Bitcoin's returns, and, you know, they're leveraging Bitcoin. But I think it's a double-edged sword. I think for the most part, it's a good thing. We're lucky in that I think we've got a good faith actor in Michael Saylor, who accounts for 95% of the entire market. And so, you know, you look at, say, number two or number three is Metaplanet, and, you know, they've got a total of 20,000 coins or just under, and Saylor's bought that literally in 1 week. So there are just scales of this that are immensely different. And given that we've got, I think, the two leading treasury companies in MicroStrategy and Metaplanet being good faith actors and wanting the best for Bitcoin, I think we're in pretty safe hands. Yes, there's going to be a whole host of copycats, which I don't think are going to be as successful as those two, but I think it's, you know, choose what level of risk you're willing to take if you do dabble in that. I think we've seen over the last few years, Saylor has proved himself in every facet with every challenge that's been presented with him or to him in Bitcoin. And I think Simon and Dylan at Metaplanet have held themselves impeccably, particularly with some interesting or curious things that they've had to face. And they've been nothing but transparent to the market.
Yeah, they really have. And I think that all of these, you know, new CEOs kind of coming in are trying to take note of that. And, you know, especially Saylor being, you know, Saylor, and he's tweeting out basically every single Monday, it seems, that they're buying Bitcoin. The transparency is very unique in this Bitcoin space. Now, obviously, you've got some experience in the traditional financial realm. You know, do you think that these treasury companies, I believe there's like 160 now publicly traded companies worldwide, at least as of this recording today, there's, you know, seemingly a new one popping up every single day, but, you know, 160 right now, are all of these, you know, making enough noise where traditional finance is starting to see, hey, you know what, Saylor's starting to tap into that $300 trillion global bond market, and there's all these other products coming up where, you know, they're starting to, I guess, quote unquote, financialize Bitcoin, or maybe Bitcoinize financial products in a sense where, you know, now traditional finance is now really starting to take this serious?
I think there's a lot with that question. And I think if I struck that down into two parts, we are seeing the Bitcoinization of the financial world through these Bitcoin treasury companies. And at the same time, there is a risk attached to it. It's not all a free kick. There's a serious amount of risk attached to this. And I'll just highlight the example of this with GameStop. GameStop is effectively a zombie company sitting on a pile of cash that announced to the market they're going to become a Bitcoin treasury company. Now, they failed to follow through on that and disappointed the market enormously because they said, oh, we'll buy a little bit of Bitcoin, and they've left the majority of that cash sitting in cash. Now, for a treasury company to succeed, they need to be 100% committed to the strategy. You can't run an alternate business and hope to have a Bitcoin treasury company on the side. I'm not sure if you've heard the story of the pig and the chicken when it comes to breakfast.
No, I haven't.
So
let's hear it.
So the pig and the chicken, these Bitcoin treasury companies want to have their cake and eat it too, the new companies that are sort of trying the Bitcoin treasury strategy. And the problem is that you cannot be serious about being a treasury company. You have to be committed. And back to the breakfast, you know, when we talk about the chicken and the pig, the chicken's serious about breakfast because that's its egg on the table, but the pig's committed because it's his ass on your breakfast plate. And if you're going to pursue these Bitcoin treasury strategies, there's no half measures available to you in this. If you do a half measure in the treasury companies, sounds like I'm in a ghetto. If you do the half measures with the treasury companies, the market will punish you for not being aggressive enough. So you have to jump in with 2 feet. You have to be the pig on the plate. You cannot just be half committed to this strategy because the market will absolutely punish you. And so that's where I think with so many options in place, it's hard to know who is serious and who is committed. So I think it warrants a huge amount of work to get comfortable with that, because I think there are a lot of companies who will have a false start with it, and then they'll get scared by the volatility and they'll step back from that strategy altogether.
So do you think that GameStop, in a sense, almost regrets, you know, kind of going through with this Bitcoin strategy just because they weren't all in? Because, I mean, you know, GameStop had this, I guess, the short squeeze that everybody, you know, remembers back from the Cerveza sickness days, you know, just 5 years ago. And then now we have, you know, them not really going all in on Bitcoin, even though Ryan Cohen was pictured, it was rumored for a long time. It seemed like this would be almost a perfect marriage, putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet. But like you said, they didn't necessarily go all in. So, you know, do you think that it's almost like a regret for some of these companies that don't jump with 2 feet in?
I think absolutely. Look at the share price since they've done it. It's been disappointing, to say the least. And there was a huge hoopla made about this strategy that they were looking to implement. Ryan spoke at the Las Vegas conference this year for the Bitcoin Magazine conference. And the expectation was this was going to be the start of a strategy that would not only invest all of their cash into Bitcoin, it would then start creating the debt instruments for it. And back to one of the things that we didn't cover earlier, with these 160 treasury companies come to place, the bond market, although it's the biggest market in the world, there's $300 trillion of liquidity there. They're probably the most astute investors in the world. They're not going to want to have the second, third, fourth best issuance of this debt across a number of different companies. I think there's going to be market leaders in each jurisdiction, and there's maybe going to be room for 3 or 4 in total. And I could be completely wrong, but it looks that way to me, that there'll be the winners and the losers. The winners can issue as much debt as they see fit, and the losers will basically 10-0 and we'll have a consolidation. So we're just in that Cambrian explosion phase of market movements where everything is possible, and we'll have a consolidation and the realization that there are winners and losers, and now there'll be a select few winners.
Now, so are you saying basically MSTR, MicroStrategy, because it's the big dog, that it, like, you know, coming in second place is essentially, you know, the consolidation, like nobody's going to ever catch them?
I don't think so. I think this is very much like Zeno's paradox, the thought experiment that if you move 50% closer to your target, how close are you? You know, when do you reach the wall? And the fact is, you never reach the wall. And so in this line of thinking, MicroStrategy represents the wall. And, you know, all these Bitcoin treasury companies starting, they get 50% closer to the wall in their first step. Then they get 50% again, and they're 75% of the way there. They're going to get closer and closer to MicroStrategy. I just don't think they can ever be toppled. because they've got such a huge lead. And the other thing is that they're forging a whole host of new markets and breaking that open for everyone else. But there's a level of maturity that these companies need to reach in order to do that for themselves. Just because Sailor did it doesn't mean that a company that's a year old can go to the debt markets and say, hey, let's do this.
What if I told you you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven.
They're not going to, no debt market participant is really going to provide any amount of liquidity or capital to that type of investment. And so they need to have, Michael's had 5 years at this nearly. Literally next month, he's been at this for 5 years. So he's got a demonstrable track record of 5 years of buying Bitcoin and telling the market exactly what he'll do and being 100% straight and honest with them. So when he goes to the bond market, and there's $300 trillion there and he tells them something, they're going to believe him. But if a Johnny come lately comes along and tries to do that same thing as well, just because, oh, well, he did it, we can do it. No, there's a $50 billion balance sheet or more. There's, what is it? It's probably close to a $70 billion balance sheet now, or net asset value on that balance sheet. And he's got a 5-year track record of being impeccable with his word. Those things matter.
Now, what about these different markets, right? Because obviously we have the US, which is the biggest global market there is, but it seems like there's going to be potentially like a leader, like you said, like Metaplanet, right? I mean, Japan is very interesting when it comes to, it's just connection to the United States in general. And Sailor said something interesting in one of his talks that he was not worried that, you know, Metaplanet might catch them, but the Japanese debt market is so big that, you know, somebody in the bond market, these bond investors, they're just have zero faith in the bonds because they have negative interest rates that, you know, they're looking for something like a Metaplanet. And so he's going to be able to potentially catch them. Do you see that as a scenario just because of, like, you know, the uniqueness of the Japanese market?
Look, there's a lot of things I really like about Metaplanet. The first is that it's a vassal state. Japan's a vassal state of the US. So by default, you get a lot of the property protections of investing in the US by investing in Japan, which I think is very different to the rest of Asia. The other thing that I think is really important is that it has a very different setup from the US. And that would be, and I'd probably have to check with others on this, but my expectation would be that that is the biggest Eurodollar market on Earth, with the lowest interest rate. So when you pair those two things together, that is a huge, huge opportunity for the Japanese market and any Bitcoin treasury company in that market. Because when you pair low interest rates, ultra low interest rates of circa 0.5% to 1%, with the ability to get a return on your capital, such that Bitcoin represents when you package it up into a bond or a convertible note, there is a huge arbitrage that makes Japan and the Bitcoin treasury companies in Japan much more appealing than treasury companies in the US. And just looking at this in really rough numbers, last time I checked, Simon was talking about issuing, you know, the potential of issuing bonds at a 4% to 5% rate versus MicroStrategy, which was issuing at a 10% rate. Well, straight off the bat, that allows them to buy double the amount of, or that allows them to afford double the amount of debt for the same purchase, for the same amount of interest expense. So I look at that and think they're extremely well placed relative to everyone else on Earth for those few unique characteristics of their market.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that that's going to be something that unique to watch into. And it's always been, you know, something that I think is very curious with all of this. So it's just the interaction of the different markets. But I want to get into retail. The narrative right now is that retail isn't here. But on the flip side of things, everybody's reporting how much the ETFs are buying. And the assumption is it's institutional investors. But these reports that have come out say like 70 to 80% of ETF buying is from retail, and these institutional buyers aren't here. So, you know, from getting your ear to the street, which one do you think it is? Do you believe the narrative that retail isn't here, or do you think it's, you know, more institutions are, you know, just having a select few that are really buying?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think the notion retail's not here comes from, that old homage to the Google searches, that basically no one's searching for Bitcoin, so where is everyone? I think there is an opaqueness with the institutional market and money, and those ETFs do a very good job of hiding where that money comes from. You know, we really just rely on BlackRock and Fidelity to tell us what's happening. To me, the most interesting thing about that, which I think is a huge step forward for us, and it's a wonderful thing to see because this is something I've been wanting to see for a number of years now, is we have just recently, the SEC came out and said that the ETFs can make in-kind deposits and redemptions. So I look at this and think that is an enormous, enormous opportunity for Bitcoin. Now, all of a sudden, this may seem unpopular, and don't shoot the messenger, but there's going to be a whole host of, you know, OG Bitcoiners who no longer want to self-custody their Bitcoin, or they want to access traditional financial markets. They don't want to have a capital gains tax paid on transferring it to get the same exposure, but want it custodied and want some relief for that self-custody that they've been doing. I look at this and think this is going to bring about a whole host of opportunities for Bitcoiners who are holding it. There's going to be a whole host of financial products that are built around that. This, to me, represents one step closer to the banks being able to custody Bitcoin. You had the SEC lay down the foundation that they said they could custody it. This is one step closer to it, and we're going to start seeing a whole host of products, financial products built on the back of it, which, look, I'm there's probably no bigger advocate for not your keys, not your coins than myself. We have a business running self-custody and helping clients all over the globe with self-custody, but at the same time, you've got to meet people where they are, and a lot of people aren't ready for self-custody, but this is a way to get the rest of the population into the wonderful benefits of Bitcoin, and then they will, through their own endeavors, go down the rabbit hole to find out why they want to be self-custodying. So I look at this as just another top of funnel adoption mechanism for Bitcoin into the mainstream.
Now, why do you think the in-kind is so big? Do you just think it's more of just the OGs trying to access, whether it's, you know, traditional loans or something else? You know, because that is interesting. I do think it's big, but, you know, I wasn't really thinking the OGs were going to come back. So I'm curious on that point. Why do you think the OGs are looking to get into these more financial-based products?
I think for a number of reasons. Firstly, if you look at the interest rate differential on loans for those type of facilities versus something else, I know globally there are lenders who can give you a sub 5% loan on that type of facility, whereas the best I've seen in Bitcoin terms has been, say, single digits, just under single digit interest rates on loan products. So for one, that's an immediate benefit, but probably the bigger, more intangible benefit, although there is a tangible element to this, is that it legitimizes the Bitcoiner's wealth. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with OG Bitcoiners who are sitting on hundreds, if not thousands, of coins, and they don't have any way of monetizing their Bitcoin in a legitimate fashion, or they're scared to. This allows them to transfer without any capital gains tax to a financial institution their Bitcoin, and legitimately finance that in a way that they might want to buy a car, buy a home, pay the kids' school fees, whatever it might be. But it's a way of monetizing that Bitcoin that they otherwise haven't had. And it's a double-edged sword because, you know, we want to have less and less Bitcoin. points are custody by the major institutions, but there are some benefits on a personal level that people will want to take advantage of.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because the IBIT ETF, I don't know if you saw this, but the SEC just improved 10xing the limit from 25,000 to 250,000 contracts. So it'll allow everybody to you know, take on much more exposure, obviously 10x the exposure. Now, do you normally see moves like this when it comes to, you know, traditional financial products or like ETFs, or is this like, is everything that we're just seeing here with the Bitcoin ETFs just unheard of?
I just think we're in new ground. We Bitcoin ETFs at this point in time, that is unusual to have a product that's less than 18 months old have its limits increased by 10x. That is very rare. I'd love to see the stats on how many companies' financial instruments have actually had that approved, and I think you'd be able to count them on one hand. But I just look at that is really a function of the success of Bitcoin and the ETF. This has been the best, most successful launch for BlackRock. It's the biggest ETF or the fastest growing ETF they've ever had. The crowd has spoken. They want this. And this is why I think the SEC is, under this administration, the US is acting more to deliver what the people want. And, you know, 25,000 units in that contract were not enough. So it's now 250,000. So the leverage on Bitcoin in these options can just get, can be so much higher.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer. All the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show. Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, I don't think that traditional finance has just gotten to the point to realize just about this overall digital scarcity and scarcity just in general of Bitcoin. And I don't know if a lot of Bitcoiners truly understand it as well, just because, you know, we had Jack Mallers go on and on CNBC as he does, or, you know, one of the traditional media outlets today say, hey, you know what, you know, I'm going to still be buying at 120, 130, 140, 150. There's not a price that I won't be buying Bitcoin. And I just see all of this Bitcoin getting taken off exchanges and getting and moving into hands, the ETFs increasing, all of this buying pressure. You know, we did see that short squeeze with GameStop, which we talked about a little bit earlier. Like, do you see there being a potential of that here with Bitcoin, just the way that we're seeing the amount of buying pressure? Or are you more along the line with your fellow Aussie, Checkmatey, who thinks we're going to get that slow grind up to that 1 million?
Oh, it's hard to argue with Checkmatey because he's just clinical in his analysis. So I think I'll put a foot in both camps to disappoint you. If I look at it, I think, and this is Check to a T, I think he'll be right 99% of the time. We're going to get a slow grind to 1 million. And then there's a 1% chance that we find someone who runs a central bank, has access to a money printer, and can hold the fingers down till they bleed and just buy Bitcoin and set a new price at $1 million. And I know if I had that opportunity for the Australian or the Reserve Bank in Australia, I'd just go into the Treasury and I would literally buy. I'd set up accounts all over the globe with every single exchange I could possibly find. And then I would just start buying, whether it's $1 million a minute or $10 million a minute, it wouldn't matter. But I would literally just buy until there was no more Bitcoin sitting on exchange. And then the price would be whatever it is, but the buy order would be in and it'd be $1 million a minute or $1 million every 10 seconds. And those buys would just keep going until liquidity dried up or we found ourselves at $1 million a coin.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because like all of this is kind of coming on to the scene right now, and everybody's talking about all of the Bitcoin, you know, being scooped up by these treasury companies. And tomorrow, we actually have the U.S. going into their strategic reserve and, you know, kind of breaking it all down, how much Bitcoin they actually had. There's been speculation that the U.S. sold it off. Somebody found a wallet seized by the U.S. Marshals that only had 28,000 instead of the 200,000. Obviously, this has all been kind of some speculation here, but I think it's kind of a unique twist here that we've had Bo Hines even say, hey, you know what? We don't have to report the buying and we don't have to be as open as Michael Saylor has been. So I'm kind of the opinion, maybe, you know, I'll look dumb after this episode comes out because they're not doing it tomorrow. But I think that there's a slight chance that they've been buying kind of behind closed doors. Maybe they'll announce it tomorrow. I'm not sure, but I know that they're definitely like looking into it, right? They have all these Bitcoin bulls on the U.S. government. Now, do you think that that is coming soon? Or do you think that, you know, that because of the way that governments are, it's just going to move slow and more of these treasury companies, that's kind of the new wave of this cycle. And the governments, maybe next cycle is when we'll start to actually see them come in.
Oh, I, without wanting to sound totally cynical about this, I think that's a very good question. But the bigger question is, can we move forward with this now or not? And the fact that Trump's media company bought $2 billion worth a week or two ago, that now opens the possibility that the government can now buy it. Because I can't see, without wanting to sound too conspiratorial, just look at what the leader of the free world just did. He went and bought $2 billion worth of Bitcoin for his own personal company. That now opens a pathway for the rest of the US and the Strategic Reserve to go full hog into it, is what I would say. So I think it's not a matter of if it happens. I think it's a matter of when, and we might be a whole lot closer to that situation than where we were previously.
Oh man. All right, Peter, you're going to get me all bullish here. There we go. I love to hear that. But I definitely think that this whole kind of aspect is very interesting, right? I mean, you know, we're having the, like you said, the leader of the free world come in, he's buying $2 billion worth of Bitcoin and, you know, for his company. And that's just kind of the new wave. But, you know, we kind of touched on it briefly, and something else that Senator Lummis announced today, I'm not quite sure if you saw it, but now that the United States, they can officially look at Bitcoin and digital assets as collateral or as part of, you know, something that to buy a home. Now, we talked about Wells Fargo CEO already talking about Bitcoin's dipping into the $300 trillion bond market. Is Bitcoin going to, you know, is the housing market next up? Is it kind of like that meme with the, you know, the Grim Reaper, where at first Bitcoin's like taking down the bond market and now it's coming for real estate next? Is that how significant you kind of see this move being?
I haven't read the details on it, but one thing that would give me a great deal of confidence in that being part of the move to do that and take down the real estate market is if the investor or the mortgagee protections are in place for the borrower, like they are for residential property. So the US, Australia, most of the Western world have got provisions in place that if you take out a mortgage on a property, a residential property, that is, commercial is a very different beast. But on residential property, governments around the world have wanted stability in that practice of borrowing money to buy your home. And so they've instituted that if you, as a lender, you only get one time to value that property if the contract is in good working order. And so just let me explain that. So when you buy a home, they go and take out, the valuer comes in, values the property and says, right, $1 million property, it's valued at $1 million. The bank will lend you $800,000 on that. You then go and get your 10-year or your 30-year fixed mortgage or your variable rate mortgage, and you pay that off. Now, if that property drops in value to $500,000, as long as you meet your mortgage repayments, the bank, the lender, is never going to come for that property and tell you that you've either got to give the property back or you've got to top up the collateral that they took out on that. It's kind of the risk that the lenders take in lending money to you in that form of contract. To me, if Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, are able to create that type of a surety for people who are borrowing using Bitcoin, I look at that and think all of a sudden that can tamper the downside volatility to it. That if you hold that Bitcoin loan for 10 years, then you're not going to get a margin call. And that's going to allow an enormous amount of leverage capital to go into the Bitcoin space and really disrupt that cost of housing, that monetization of housing. And so what you'll see is you'll see a sucking sound coming out of the property market and going into the Bitcoin market. So that to me is probably the most important leverage, part of leveraging Bitcoin that really needs to be solved for, is making sure that there's no margin call on it if you hold it for a specific duration. Much the same as residential property gets that same free kick now and is afforded those type of protections. If you were able, if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were able to guarantee that, two things would happen. Firstly, and this isn't popular, but Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would probably have to custody that Bitcoin to ensure that they've still got it. But most importantly is, as long as you made your monthly commitment on that mortgage on your Bitcoin, you'd be able to ride through any downturn, which is a superpower.
Yeah, it's interesting. They did come out and say that you need to have your Bitcoin custodied in some sort of like US approved entity. So I'm not sure how specific that is, if it's like you need to have it with Coinbase, BlackRock, you know, a publicly traded entity, or like a Cash App or Strike or something that is approved in the US. I'm not quite sure the details on that exactly, but you know, it seems like that's also another wave that's kind of popping up here as well, where the Bitcoin collateralized loans, you know, why do you think that, you know, like you said, that the traditional financial world, you know, you can deposit these in-kind redemptions, you could potentially get some 5%, but we aren't seeing that a lot of times with a lot of these just Bitcoin specific companies. Is there, you know, maybe some disconnect with the still the traditional financial world with the Bitcoin space still? You know, why is there, you know, why are you, I guess, able to get such much lower rates when I think, like, you know, I Salt is a sponsor of the show. They give like 8.9, I think, is the lowest. Strike, you know, I think gives just around 10. Like all these corporations, you know, they're getting like high single digits to maybe double digits at that point. Why aren't they not able to give the 5% like traditional finance?
I think twofold. Firstly, they don't have access to unlimited pools of capital like the banks do. They can't create their own fiat to loan out. Secondly, there's a misunderstanding of the risk that is entailed with lending on Bitcoin. To me, Bitcoin represents the best form of collateral because it's 24/7, 365 liquid. There's no other collateral on earth that allows you to sell something down in the event that you get close to that margin and it needs to be liquidated. There's no other market on earth that has that flexibility. And what's interesting is that from a lending perspective, that completely changes the whole dynamic of lending. At the moment, we've got the three C's of lending: character, collateral, and capacity. Character refers to whether or not you're going to pay the loan back. Capacity refers to whether or not you can service it. And then collateral refers to whether or not there's any value in what you're giving them that they can resell at a future point in time. When you do a Bitcoin loan, there's really only one thing you need to look at, and that is who is custodying the Bitcoin, because they don't care about capacity because they're holding your collateral. They're not worried about the collateral because they know it's 24/7, 365. And because they're holding your collateral, there's no requirement or servicing capacity, i.e. capacity to repay that loan that needs to go into it. So it's a very simple lending product that really simplifies things dramatically. And this is probably one of my bugbears, where we have a misappropriation in that the world thinks we've got a debt problem, but what we really have is we have a collateral problem. The world doesn't have a debt problem, because if we had a debt problem, we would simply take whatever collateral is secured against that debt and everything would be okay. But the problem is that the collateral that has been put up to secure the debts that are out there at the moment are precisely worth nothing. So now we have a debt problem. It's really a collateral problem. So the world thinks we've got a debt problem, but it's really a collateral problem disguised as a debt problem, because if you call in your debts, there's no there to recover what's outstanding for you.
Now, that's interesting that you're saying all this. Okay, so let's break that down a little bit more, because, all right, if we have a debt problem or a collateral problem, even though we're in, you know, $37 trillion worth of debt. And now we have potentially the greatest collateral on planet Earth. This bull run, I think everybody should focus on getting their Bitcoin in self-custody and off exchanges. We all saw what happened last time with the huge blow-offs. We had Celsius, FTX, all of the big dogs blowing up. Well, this time everybody's being smart and holding their Bitcoin in self-custody. This is why I'm going with the number one hardware wallet in the game. That's Trezor. You can go to trezor.io or the affiliate link below to get yours for 5% off using promo code GreenCandle. Get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. They are a trusted brand. They've been in the game the longest of any hardware wallets out there. So that's why I've partnered with them, making it the easiest for you to get your Bitcoin off exchanges and not have to worry about any counterparty risk. So do it today. Go to the affiliate link below. Use promo code GreenCandle. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show. Is this going to be like more of a savior of the dollar, or do we get to that, you know, hyper Bitcoinized world eventually?
I think this helps bring in a hyper Bitcoinized world. And one of the major tools I see helping bring this in is a mutual friend of ours, CJ. Those Bitcoin bonds, the principal protected notes, I look at as a key way to fast forward hyper Bitcoinization. Those principal protected notes, I think, are going to be a huge demand driver for Bitcoin. And I look at this and how they work very briefly is if you're selling a principal protected note, you can offer a capital guaranteed Bitcoin bond where you structure a product where you've got 80% of it tied to a municipal bond or a US Treasury that pays 5%. And the remaining 20% then goes into buying Bitcoin. And what you have at the end of the five-year period, if you take what happened in the last 5 years and assume it'd be the same over the next 5 years, that billion-dollar bond with an $800 million allocation to bonds and $200 million allocation to Bitcoin would be worth $3 billion. So you've created $2 billion of equity out of effectively nothing, out of a capital-guaranteed product. That would give you an annualized return of close to 20% on a risk-free product. Now, if you peel the layers back on that, I know, right? It just sounds crazy. But if you peel the layers back on this, the really important part about this is that this becomes the flywheel that creates escape velocity for hyper-Bitcoinization, I believe, because there's roughly, call it somewhere between $60 to $70 trillion worth of bonds per annum that need to get refinanced. Now, if you effectively created that type of structured product, with, let's say, half of the bonds, call it $30 trillion worth of bonds a year, and you put 20% of that into Bitcoin, you now have demand for $6 trillion worth of Bitcoin purchases per annum, which would be like finding another 500 Michael Saylors.
That's crazy.
What that does to price of Bitcoin is that will mean the CAGR will increase dramatically over the next 10 years rather than go into that the conversation about the declining returns over time. Absolutely not. I don't want to see that. I'm not ready for declining returns yet. That's why I want to see these type of products come into place. I want to see this as a way to recapitalize the banking system. Ironically, it will lead to strengthening the banking system, not bringing it down. But unfortunately, Bitcoin is enemy's money as well. So we take the good with the bad. It'd be really great for price appreciation. It'd be great for hyper-Bitcoinization. It'd restabilize the banks. It'd help us pay off all our debts. Within a five-year period, here's the crazy thing. Within a five-year period, that $25 trillion a year that you've put into principal protected notes that's taken out $5 trillion worth of Bitcoin every year, in the space of 10 years, if we did that on the entire market, could create about $3 quadrillion worth of equity.
I mean, does that mean it's all going to go towards Bitcoin? And all right, so yes. We've got three quadrillions worth of equity towards Bitcoin.
Correct.
Well, I mean, the multiplier effect at this point is, you know, anywhere from 8 to 25%. I think 8x to 25. So meaning every dollar that goes into Bitcoin, the market cap increases by 8 or 25 on the very volatile times. So then we're looking at, you know, not only just getting well past gold, but, you know, being the dominant force and potentially taking over all of these other markets. And is that basically what you potentially foresee with more of these products coming online? Is like, hey, we're not just talking about gold as this the biggest asset. We're looking at the, you know, $350 trillion real estate market. We're looking at the $300 trillion global bond market. All of these things are just going to get swallowed up by Bitcoin, and these products are going to be the reason why.
I've got no doubt. I see it clearly. A lot of people think, oh, that's not possible. That's not going to happen. And it's like, just stick around a little while and just watch this all come to fruition. This is the only reason why I talk about this stuff, because unless we talk about it and get that into the zeitgeist, we're not going to have these products developed and create the solutions that we need. But to me, it's clear as day, because if I take a step back, the number one problem that we have with our financial system at the moment is that we have Wall Street taking huge speculative bets on Main Street assets. And so what do I mean by that? We've got the securitization and monetization of the American housing market, real estate market, both with the residential mortgage-backed securities and commercial mortgage-backed securities. That's effectively a leverage bet on the US property market. And you then have Wall Street basically betting in the bond market, betting on the success and failure of US housing, US property. This is where Bitcoin becomes really interesting, because Bitcoin's a wildly volatile asset, and this allows Wall Street to maintain speculative bets without mainstream consequence. And that is the most important thing that Bitcoin will deliver the world. This is the divorce of the money printer and government. This is the ability for Wall Street to have its cake and eat it too. They can start having, you know, wild speculation on an asset that has no forbearance or impact on the day-to-day cost of living and housing affordability. And so what we're going to see is the monetary premium sucked out of the American housing market. We're going to see the monetary premium sucked out of the US stock market. And all of that speculative action is going to move into Bitcoin. And this is why I find it amusing that, to me, it's clear as day that we're going to see the Bitcoin market be in the quadrillions of dollars, while all the other assets combined may make up a quarter of what's there.
So then it'll be basically Bitcoin, 75% of all assets, and then 25%. And then, you know, eventually everything just becomes Bitcoinized at that point, right? Because it's just the behemoth at that point.
Correct. And obviously at that point in time, it really starts leveling out, that, you know, then we get to the diminishing returns. But we've got so much demonetization to swallow in Bitcoin that I think we've got 10, 20 years of 50, 60, 70% CAGRs in front of us.
And it's crazy to me that that's like looked at as bad. It's like, hey, that's diminishing returns. It's like 50, 60, 70% CAGR, which, you know, if you crunch the numbers, that's, you know, that's pretty damn good. And that's beating the Michael Saylor prediction of, you know, 21 million in 21 years, like a 21 CAGR. So he sees it as more of, you know, diminishing returns. And you know, I think it's interesting the way you put it, because I really do think that when we look at the way that Bitcoin has developed and we look at Bitcoin just on surface level, the fixed 21 million supply, let's call it 18.5 million with all the lost coins and Satoshi and everything else, you know, that scarcity that we have, we've never seen a financial based product for it. And it's seemingly like the debt market is infinite. So I don't see how this diminishing returns sort of hubbub could actually come to light because of that. Because, you know, eventually we're going to hit what, an infinite at a certain point in time. And so if we've got all that, we've got Trump and the US actually announcing that they want to borrow another $1.5 trillion within the next two quarters towards the end of this year. I mean, you know, if you look at the global M2 money supply, and if you look at, you know, the amount that the government spends, Bitcoin price is pretty correlated with that. And both of those seem to always go up. So, you know, I think at a certain point in time, you know, something's going to crack. But is there anything that you look at in particular to see as this money starting to flow into Bitcoin? Or is it kind of like accumulation of all of these things I'm just lining out here?
No, I think you're perfectly correct in that. I think it's death by a thousand paper cuts. Now, people are going to get it when they get it. But at some point in time, it becomes irrefutable, the evidence before your eyes. And to talk about Saylor's expectation of $21 million a coin in 21 years, I would pair that, and, you know, with the greatest of respect to Michael, he's the chairman of a $100 billion company and needs to stay within a range of acceptable limits from an Overton window perspective. So I think he may be on the low end of that expectation over the next few years by looking at some very conservative assumptions. And this is where I think he's doing a great job in moving that Overton window forward dramatically, that now all of a sudden people are discussing in sincere terms the possibility of a $21 million Bitcoin. Whereas until the CEO of a $100 billion company started talking about it, you know, it didn't seem possible. So huge, huge hat tip to Michael in moving that Overton window forward.
Yeah, and he seemed to, you know, more so like move his, I guess, like bullish expectations up. Like he keeps increasing his price predictions every single time it seems like he goes on stage. So I wouldn't be surprised if we come back next year and we see him at Prague or on Vegas and one of these things and give a speech as to why he thinks Bitcoin's going to, you know, 210 million opposed to just 21 million at a certain point in time, right?
It always moves up, let me tell you. Probably the most famous person in the space prior to Michael would have been Cathy Wood from a TradFi perspective. And, you know, I watched Cathy, who I think is absolutely brilliant, move her expectations for Bitcoin dramatically forward. And I think her optimistic outlook now is that one Bitcoin will be $1.5 million a coin in 2030. But I can assure you a few years ago, it wasn't that ambitious.
And I think all of these price predictions are just getting higher and higher and higher too. And it's like at a certain point, how can you not? I mean, you know, with the current economic situation, we haven't even talked about that because, you know, we've got an interesting political theater is what I'll call it right now between Trump and Powell, where Trump has talked about he's going to potentially fire him and all this and that. You know, Powell is seemingly going to hold strong tomorrow. We're recording this the day before the July FOMC meeting. But, you know, if you look at the CME group, there's about a 2% chance that they actually cut interest rates tomorrow. So, you know, how would you describe, I guess, the overall just macroeconomic environment right now and the role that Bitcoin's kind of playing in it right now?
I think we're in a very unique time. There's a whole host of, I guess, economic experiments taking place before our very eyes. And if you read the textbooks, you read Keynesian or were a subscriber to Keynesian economics, you would see that all of these tariffs and the economic games that are being played by the administration were going to be extremely detrimental to the American consumer and would unbalance trade. It would lead to a hugely negative connotation and impact to the American economy. And what we've seen is we've seen Trump basically tip the board upside down, create all these new tariffs, and it seems to have had little to no impact on the American consumer and the American economy at large. So I look at this and think, well, isn't that interesting? We're now in a new paradigm where traditional wisdom in economics is no longer dictating what the policy should be. And we have an administration who's trying things that have never been done before. So I find it endlessly fascinating, the economic situation at this point in time. I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as the doomers say. And I actually think we're in a quite strong economic position right now. We've had rates at 5% for nearly the last 3 years, and the economy's still kicking. So people are still spending money, and yes, housing market's sort of gone by the by, but that kind of had to happen anyway because it was such an unproductive use of resources and investment. I think this sounds wildly unpopular, but I think Powell's done Bitcoin as a huge, huge service, that when interest rates are at 5%, housing affordability becomes very tough. The property market prices need to drop. Speculative investment in that asset class is going to drop dramatically. And here we are, despite Bitcoin, you know, saying that it was only good in zero rate policy. here we are with rates at 5% for the last 3 years and Bitcoin's at all-time highs.
Why would you ever hold generational wealth on a piece of paper? It doesn't make sense. You need a foolproof solution, and I've got it for you. You could get this as low as $25, and if you use promo code GreenCandle, you could get 10% off. Being around for 12 years, they've engineered the perfect and most easy to use solution. I've partnered with CryptoSteel to offer for you guys just that. It is the cheapest and most secure way to store your seed phrase. I don't know about you guys, but I don't have too many things where I think one ton is going to fall on this, but it could survive all of that and more. So go to CryptoSteel.com. You can use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order if you go there today. So go ahead and protect your generational wealth and do it with CryptoSteel. All right, enough from me. Back to the show.
I look at that and think, ha, isn't that interesting? All the experts were wrong again.
Yeah, it definitely is very interesting to see all that because everybody was saying, hey, you know what? Powell's going to cut interest rates. Everything's going to be fine. But the way that, you know, I feel like just the cutting of the interest rates when it happens, right? That's just going to accelerate Bitcoin's growth and everything. Every other asset class has just been kind of lagging except for Bitcoin. So I know we kind of talked about at the beginning of the show, hey, you know, why isn't the price moving as much? I feel like once we kind of like, you know, get that money printer going, that's when all bets are off because we have so much buying pressure already from all of these, you know, companies. Once rates get lower for them to borrow and obtain debt to, you know, buy more Bitcoin and then just on a personal level, or do you think people are going to start to flock into other assets? Like, you know, maybe it'll help out the, let's call it the global bond market or help out the real estate market. Or are people just looking for those bigger returns and Bitcoin seems to be the only answer?
There's a lot in that question. And probably to finish off on the previous question around what's happening economically, the thing that I have trouble with in traditional finance is that none of the figures that we look at have any meaning. And what do I mean by that is we've got, you know, GDP figures, which tell us how well the economy is growing. We've got inflation rates, which tell us how much more we've got to pay for our goods. And we've got, you know, future forecasts on unemployment numbers that get re-rated after the fact. I look at this and I think there are three key economic indicators we look at for the health of the economy. And those institutions have been politicized to create a narrative that the politicians can go to the polls with. So I look at that and think traditional economic metrics are completely out the window now. They're of zero use in a Bitcoin world. And this is where fast-tracking the adoption of Bitcoin, hyper-Bitcoinizing the world, whether that's through the Bitcoin treasury companies or through, you know, personal investment in Bitcoin and self-custody and having all of these products around it, I think is the only way that we get through this problem that we've got right now. And the opportunity I see in the people I speak to is, you know, they're sitting on millions, if not tens of millions of dollars of property, real estate, and they don't want to hold this anymore. They're looking at this with interest rates at 5%. Property's no longer affordable. It's no longer a great investment. And yes, when interest rates drop, there'll obviously be the initial kick, but have we reached terminal capacity for debt and the repayment of debt in our society? I kind of get the feeling we are. And the only way to do that is to inflate the way out of the problem. Now, the only way to inflate the way out of the problem without having downstream impact on cost of housing, cost of living, is to inflate the Bitcoin bubble. So just send that thing to $250 billion total market cap, and there's no downstream consequence to it because everyone wants to hold Bitcoin. They don't want the other assets. So this is, you know, sort of a theme I've talked on today is it's really important to divorce Wall Street speculation from Main Street consequence. This allows everyone to speculate on Bitcoin, demonetizes all of the asset classes that we've got. Ironically, it wouldn't demonetize them at all. They'd just stay the same. It'd be like watching the Japanese economy for the last 30 years. It's basically flatlined from 30 years ago. It hasn't gone anywhere over a 30-year period. It just means that, you know, for the next 30 years, property is going to go nowhere. Stocks are really going to go nowhere, but Bitcoin's going to go up 1,000 times.
Oh man, Peter, can you get me more bullish? I mean, my goodness, man. With all of this, I mean, I just see it, everything just kind of scooting over towards Bitcoin, and it's happening quick. And so you saying all, you know, the 10 to 15 years diminished returns, man, I feel like I'm like Kathy Wood and Michael Saylor. I think I'm going to have to revise that and say it's going to go come a little bit quicker with all of this. But I think it's unique, like all of these products that we're starting to come on online as well. I know that you guys at the Bitcoin Advisor are cooking up something here. So I want to hear about what you guys are up to and what you guys are, I guess, seeing. And yeah, I mean, tell me how everything's going with you guys just being in the Bitcoin space during this craziness that we have going on.
You know what? Every day I get up and I've got to say I'm very fortunate that I get to help a whole host of people move their net worth into Bitcoin. And there's a great deal of satisfaction to that. And the conversations we're having is with quite wealthy baby boomers would be our most typical client. And we have deep conversations about their property portfolio, their stock portfolio. And without giving them a nudge, these are conclusions that they've reached on their own by listening to podcasts like yours. They realize that, hey, there's a limited upside to holding this property. And unfortunately, there is a whole host of liability attached to that asset as well. And a lot of people are having that shift from traditional assets into Bitcoin because they don't want the headache, they don't want the cost, they don't want the liability, they don't want the headaches from tenants calling them and in the all hours. They don't want to have to be responsible for the maintenance of the property. They might be on the other side of the world, you know, cruising the Mediterranean, and they're getting calls on having to fix someone's toilet. It's like, what on earth is going on? I thought I finished the financial game. And they realize that these assets that they used to look at as trophies are really a noose around the neck. It's a heavy load to bear, and they don't want to do that anymore. What's an asset that they can just go on holidays and not have to worry about? What's an asset that doesn't have land tax associated to it? What's an asset that allows the, you know, the monetization of this asset class? And I think there's a 1,000x return over the next 20 years in it. Sadly, there's not that type of monetization or capitalization rates available in Bitcoin, in anything but Bitcoin. Property's not going to do it. Stocks aren't going to do it. We've got most of the, you know, the American, the US stock market's trading at an average of about 23, 24 times price earnings ratio. That is insane. How is that good value? You know, one of the craziest examples on this of just how out of whack the world is right now is, you know, Warren Buffett, God love him. I wish he'd love Bitcoin, but he might die before he gets it. I hope not. I'd love to see him as a Bitcoin bull. There'd be nothing better for Bitcoin than that. But I look at this and think, you know, he was buying Coca-Cola at a price earnings ratio of 6 to 7 times back in the 80s. That thing during COVID was trading at a 30 times price earnings multiple. Doesn't make any sense.
I mean, it Warren Buffett has always been late to everything. I mean, can we just agree upon that? I mean, he was late to what, Apple? He was saying Apple was the worst company, and now he's saying Bitcoin is this and that. I mean, it seems like he's always been very, you know, I guess slow moving with these things, but you know, he goes by the Benjamin Graham, the, you know, price to earnings ratio, all of those things. I mean, it seems like those valuations and everything are just dead. And he's just got the massive amounts of cash that he has. And, you know, he was in the valuation where he was using the data before everybody else. Well, now the market seems a little bit more crazy when we have all this money and liquidity in here. So is Warren Buffett, you know, will he ever get it? I don't know. But at this point in time, it's just, it seems like value investing is dead. But you can look at it on the flip side of things. Bitcoin value investing meets all of the value investing principles. I mean, that's actually how I really got orange pilled is I was listening to Preston Pysh, the We Study Billionaires, and he was breaking down the, you know, the value investing principles. And he would talk about this, and you know, they would talk about various companies, how they're just so overvalued. And then, you know, he was like, well, if you kind of just break it down, simple supply and demand with Bitcoin, and we're seeing the demand just skyrocket up, and it's insane. And of course, we've got the limited supply. I mean, it's just a matter of time to me before this bubble just starts to pop.
I couldn't agree more. And it's funny, talking about Warren Buffett as an industry stalwart, another industry stalwart that's been in the news in the last couple of days has been Ray Dalio. And he came out, I'm not sure if you saw this, with the 15% recommendation on a portfolio allocation to gold and Bitcoin.
Yeah, he did. I saw that. It's insane.
So I've got to say, I was so amused to read this because to give you some background, about 6 years ago, I gave a presentation to one of the families that we looked after. And I cited Ray Dalio as one of his linchpins for investment was he talked about finding 15 diverse investments that are not correlated to each other and basically do those. And I said, according to Ray Dalio's principles, he's a Bitcoiner. He just doesn't know it yet. And the response I got from the families that I discussed that with was just, I was nearly laughed out of the room. They were like, oh, as if he's a Bitcoiner, like you know, you're just drawing conclusions that just aren't there. And it's extremely satisfying to watch 6 years down the track, maybe a little bit longer after that presentation, Ray Dalio literally coming out and saying, yeah, everyone should have 15% of their investments allocated to Bitcoin and gold.
Well, the sad part is, Peter, is you remember that. I hope that they did, but I have a feeling that they all just kind of let it go over in one ear, out the other. Because that's the kind of vibe I've always gotten from people when I try to explain to them in Bitcoin is, you know, you need those multiple touch points. And maybe that was one for them. Maybe you convinced some. I'm sure you did convince some of these people. But the ones that were laughing to you about Ray Dalio, man, I mean, maybe they're there right now, or maybe this is just another touch point for them. And then hopefully they'll start to get Bitcoin. I don't know if I've ever told you about one of my best friends from back home who told me about Bitcoin in 2012 and still hasn't bought it to this day. But, you know, it always seems like people get it at the price that they deserve.
It's so true. And, you know, I think all Bitcoiners suffer the same fate. A prophet has no honor in his hometown. So sadly, those that we love the most, are going to be the most reluctant to hear the message from us. And we can only put other people in front of them in the hope that that message sticks and they become a Bitcoiner and join us on this journey.
Exactly. Well, Peter, you're always generous with your time and I really appreciate you coming on. I believe this is like the third or fourth time now. So we've had some banging episodes and I feel like I learned something new from you and I get more bullish every time I talk to you. So why don't you tell people where they can find out more about you and more about the Bitcoin Advisor?
Sure thing. You can reach me at Peter BTC Advisor with an ER on X. You can reach me at thebitcoinadvisor.com on the internet. And if you're interested about borrowing on your Bitcoin for probably the most perfect use case I've seen for this loan product that we've just put together is for the Bitcoin Treasury companies. You can find more information at loanmycoins.com. And I think it's a very unique product that a lot of people who are wanting to take advantage of their equity in their Bitcoin and invest in Bitcoin treasury companies will be able to benefit from. So, Brandon, I always have the best time catching up with you. So I appreciate you having me and hope we can do it again soon.
Of course, you're a legend. And I'll put all that in the show notes. I encourage you guys all to check out Peter and the Bitcoin Advisor because this man, one of the best to do it in this space. Thank you guys all for tuning into another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them and I'll see you guys all at the next one.